Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Caitlin Davis. I'm a novelist, a non-fiction author, a journalist, and a writing teacher. And unlike, I think, most of your guests, I'm not a professor.
And this is my problem, because in order to make people who are 30 or 40 years younger than me feel important, I call them professor this and professor that. How am I going to manage this trick with you? I was going to have to call you Ms.
You just call me prof. It's fine.
Prof's fine.
I'll be an honorary prof.
On prof. So, Caitlin, what I'd like to start with, if that's okay, is to ask you to share with us the things that are currently preoccupying, dynamizing, retarding, interesting you.
Well, dynamizing, that's an interesting word, isn't it? I had to look that up. I wasn't quite sure if it comes from dynamic or dynamite. But I think I'm currently dynamized by living by the sea and by writing books. But it does seem trivial and you know, selfish to be talking about that when the world is so violent right now, and when, you know, I think we feel so helpless about it. But I guess that writing is escapism. So what's preoccupying, interesting me now is the book that I've recently written on the history of British female sleuths. And, you know, we hear a lot about, at the moment, in the last few years, about undiscovered voices and diversity and buried stories in publishing and in the media. But it continually amazes me just how easily women can be written out of history. And Female Private Eyes are a very good example of that.
Now, I've already confided to you off air, Caitlin, that I haven't read the new book. I've read three other of your books. So I'm flying a bit blind here. And I wonder if you could share with us, and especially me, what you found out in your search for private sleuths, because as you have mentioned, I think we have examples of fictional private sleuths and secret agents. You know, I'm thinking of Modesty Blaise as a secret agent, tough girl, Miss Marple as a detective. But it seems as though the history has left women out.
Yeah, it's the usual story, I think. And the roots of this book go back to the book I wrote about the history of Holloway Prison, which is the largest and most famous prison for women in the UK, probably in Europe, and one of the best known in the world as well, because it held all the suffragettes, and it held all the women from Greenham Common. And five women were executed there. So I found myself writing a lot about women in the criminal justice system in the last decade or so. And so one book tends to feed into another. So I'd written the history of Holloway Prison, which incredibly had not been done before, when you think how, you know, what an important place it is. And that was quite a harrowing book to write, as you can imagine, because most of the women then, as now, shouldn't have been in prison in the first place. But there was one woman that offered some light relief, and that was Zoe Progall, the great escapee. And in the 50s and 60s, she was Britain's top number one woman burglar, a title that she was very proud of. And she escaped from the prison in the greatest jailbreak in 70 years, and at the time was very well known. And after that book came out, her daughter got in touch with me. I had tried to find her and hadn't been successful. And she told me the truth, really, about her mother. You know, she put me right on quite a few things. And that set me off on, well, if her mum, Zoe Progall, was so pleased, as it was so proud to be a professional criminal, I wonder if I can find other women that, you know, would also be proud to have that title. So that set me off on writing Queens of the Underworld, covering professional female crooks from, I'm trying to remember now, early 1600s, I think, up until the present. And while I was covering the activities of a gang called the 40 Elephants, who are an all-female crime syndicate in the turn of the century in Britain, and they were massive shoplifters. And sort of around the early 1900s, they were causing so much carnage in London in particular, in the West End, in all the huge department stores, that women were being hired to catch women. So there became more and more openings, because of course, so the 40 Elephants were operating in places like Selfridges and Harrods. And you couldn't send a man in there, in the lingerie department or the hat department or the glove department or the stockings department to watch these women. They would have stood out. And so you started getting more and more women being hired as shop detectives. And what was interesting is that they were keeping watch for suspected thieves. They were then apprehending someone that they'd accused of shoplifting. And then they were giving testimony in court. And that was really the bit that got me, because women weren't allowed to join the police force in Britain at that time. And even when they could, they couldn't arrest anyone. And their male colleagues on the whole blocked them from giving evidence. They didn't like women giving evidence in court. So here were these shop detectives, and I just thought, wow, they sound like really tough women. I wonder who they were. And then I thought, well, who were the first female detectives? Were there any during Sherlock Holmes's time, for example? And of course, if you just listed, there's plenty of fictional female sleuths. But what about the real women, and what crimes were they solving, and who hired them? So that's my very long answer to your question about private inquiries and just setting off to try and find these private detectives.
No, look, that's not a long answer. If you were an academic, you'd have been rabbiting on for at least another 15 minutes before I got half a word in. No, but in all seriousness, that is absolutely fascinating. A story that I suddenly thought of was a couple of times when I've been waiting outside women's changing rooms in department stores. On one occasion, waiting for a girlfriend and not thinking about the fact that I was probably 20 meters away from the changing rooms, but I was looking at them because I was waiting for her to step out and say, "What do you think of this?" And I was asked to move on because I was intimidating, not deliberately, the other women, right? By one of the workers there asked me to move on, and I did. I mean, just move on, as in don't keep staring at the point. But then the other thing, when I've been there with been in such places with my younger daughter, who's only 8. Obviously, I've got a sort of duty of care to be very close to her, right? And close to the changing area, at the same time as I don't want to look as though I'm surveilling others. So this is not to say that life is tough as a man. It's simply to say that your story about the gendered nature of those spaces and that kind of work is fascinating. Hearing that there was this problem about giving evidence and so on and making arrests, even when people were in the police force, makes me wonder whether the courts were a way in which you were able, through their records, to find out about these female
Well,
slaves.
yeah, but that's a good point, because of course, private detection is you are going undercover. So here I am trying to find the first women who were doing something, and these women were very good at hiding their own identity, and the people who hired them were even better at hiding their identity, because the men of Scotland Yard were not very upfront about the fact that they were hiring women, because women were supposed to be pretty useless in general. We're not smart enough, and we're risk averse, and we're too emotional. And here was Scotland Yard hiring women from at least the 1850s. And so you find tiny little tucked away references, perhaps to a woman to a woman who's working as a detective. And as we go along from the 1850s, when we get up to perhaps the 1870s, we see the women giving evidence at court. So again, it might just be a snippet, it might just be a small little reference, but with any luck, there'll be a clue. With any luck, you'll have her name. although it might not be her real name. You possibly might have an age, you might have who she's working for, you might have where she's living. And so then you can go off on a real sort of archive search. Can I find this person? Was she a real person? And who on earth was she? And that's tricky because the woman who was apparently the pioneer of female detectives was simply called Mrs. Jenkins. Jenkins is a very common English name, then and now. So it's like, so Mrs. Jenkins worked for or was sort of hired by a man called Charles Frederick Field. And he was the chief of the Metropolitan Police's detective department. So he was an extremely well-known, well-respected individual in Victorian England. He was good friends with the novelist Charles Dickens, for example. And Charles Field, according to another chief inspector's sort of reminiscences, hired Mrs. Jenkins to help him catch two American coiners who were making counterfeit money. And he asked her to take advantage of the fact that she was friendly with the landlady of the building where the coiners were living. And so he offered her money and got, she got into the house and they discovered gold bars and silver bars and fully loaded revolvers. So Mrs. Jenkins pops up, but who on earth is she? We don't have her first name. She was apparently married to a police officer, which makes perfect sense. That's something that happened a lot. Police, male police were definitely bringing in wives or daughters or sisters to assist them with certain cases. But Mrs. Jenkins is almost impossible to track down. She becomes this sort of fictional figure. But then not long after 1854, there was another woman, Sarah Grocott, and she is a real person. And again, Charles Field hired her. So he retired from the police force and opened an office as a private inquiry agent, which is the term that would have been used in the UK back then. And he hired Sarah Grocott to spy on her mistress, basically, to find out whether she was having an affair or not. So yes, court records and press coverage of trials, that's where you start finding these women.
And because I haven't read the book, I have at least read the Grawniad's interview with you about it. And in that, they refer to a 20th century business that was set up by a notable female PI. And this is Ms. Kerner, yeah?
Yes, yeah, Annette Kerner. But you see, oh, Annette Kerner again. I had my head in my hands through a lot of this book because you're just trying to establish who these women, I'm repeating myself here, who these women are. And the leading lights really of the detective world were extremely good at PR. So they really reinvented themselves. And women in particular, they used the world of private detection to reinvent themselves, to turn themselves into somebody else. And Annette Kerner is a prime example of that. And she lied about her name. She lied about the country where she was born. She lied about the date of her birth. She lied about her marital status. She definitely had a detective agency. In 1946, she opened the Mayfair Detective Agency on Baker Street. So that's just a few doors down from her fictional hero's apartments. And according to Annette, she led a very dramatic lifestyle before she'd become a private detective. She'd been recruited by the British Secret Service around 1918 to catch, well, keep an eye on spies in sort of just about post-war Europe. And then according to her, she caught an international drug dealer in the 1920s. She tracked down a stolen Van Dyck painting in the 1930s. I mean, her stories go on and on. And a lot of them are, I don't know if you're allowed to swear on your podcast, but a lot of them are nonsense, let's just say. So she's an intriguing figure because she was a private detective. She did have an agency. And unlike the Victorian women, we can see and hear her because she persuaded Pathé News to make a film about her. So we can actually see her on the screen and hear her rather posh tones, while we're watching it. She also wrote a memoir, Adventures of a Woman Detective, I think it was called. And that was quite successful because she followed it up very quickly with further adventures of a woman detective. But Annette wasn't, she was following in a long line of women who were cut from a very sort of similar cloth, unusual women doing an unusual job, very, very good at promoting themselves and branding themselves.
That's incredibly interesting. And when does the book conclude historically?
Well, we end right now because I decided to train as a professional investigator in order to do the book. And if it was difficult to find women, to track down women from the past, it was even harder to get access to modern day PIs because, it's a sensitive area of work. I am a journalist and journalists cause suspicion wherever we go. So it was difficult. I really wanted to shadow some modern women and see what are they doing. So the structure of the book is interspersed with tracking down women from the past, and then cutting that in with me in the modern day training to become a PI. And in the UK, there is no regulation and no licensing. So actually anybody can become a PI. Whereas in the States, for example, and in Australia, there is licensing. And Republic of Ireland has business licensing. In Spain, where I think you are, I think you need a 3-year degree in order to get a license as a PI. But in Britain, which has a very, very old tradition, we've had private detectives operating for a very, very long time compared with a lot of other countries. But yes, there's no regulation. So the book comes up to the present with me qualifying as a PI and hanging out with modern women that do the job.
It sounds like a very exciting structure to the book. Really innovative.
It was a little bit tricky. You make these decisions, you think, well, what about if I do it like this? What about if I tell the story like this? And sometimes it fitted, and sometimes it was, yes, it was a struggle to try and get it to flow.
Well, it's one of the things I've noticed about some contemporary fiction in the last, say, 15, 20 years in the English language in particular, that there's a sometimes some cross-cutting of this kind, pardon me, often between time and space. And so suddenly characters will be dead when they have appeared to be alive, and then they'll be alive again when they appear to have been dead. Or one's 100 years hence, or 100 years backwards in time, or one's in a different physical location, and so on. So I think that this mixture of the archival, if you like, and the ethnographic or the participatory sounds incredibly interesting because I
See,
like that.
when you put it like that, Toby, it sounds very intellectual and academic.
Oh, you mean no one will buy the fucking book? That's
No,
sort of destroyed
I mean
the whole point
the
of our
way
conversation.
no, I
Sorry.
mean the way you've summed up what I was trying to do. It suddenly sounds quite ambitious, and I think what I wanted to do was to show the connections between then and now, to sort of show the parallels, whether it's something as obvious as women being criticized in the 1850s for doing a job that's seen as being quite sordid, and how women in the modern day are still coming up against this sort of ridiculous honey trapper myth that's been thrown at women for sort of 150 years. And that's not what they do. So it's interesting. And then also the legal changes. You can't write about private detection without writing about divorce. So you look at how the divorce laws have changed in the UK from when basically you had to be a man, you had to be rich, and you had to be very well connected in Victorian times. And then by the sort of early 1920s, women can divorce on the same grounds as men. So it's, you know, and all of that makes work for PIs.
And when you had this opportunity to be amongst these women and be one of them, not wanting to steal too much of the thunder from the book itself, which I promise I'll get hold of, because it does sound really fascinating. What were some of the major interests or obsessions that they shared? Did they talk a lot about gender discrimination?
No, they didn't, because on the whole, their attitude was, I'm not going to even give that airtime. You know, I'm not going to make a big thing about it. I'm getting on with my job. That tended to be sort of the attitude. Whereas back in the sort of late 1800s, women were having to defend their morals, so having to waste an awful lot of breath defending their morals and why they're doing this job. And as we get to the early 20 and even mid 20th century, they had to fend off a lot of questions about what does your husband think about this? I mean, that went on up until like the 1980s, really. So the women today are not really sort of paying too much attention to that. But they do also say that people come to them because they're women, that clients come to them and say, I'm so glad you're a woman, when there is no obvious connection between being a woman and the job you're being asked to solve. You know, people feel more comfortable talking to women, particularly if it's a personal matter. Women have been trained to be much better listeners. So you can see why. You know, somebody would want to go to a woman.
One of my frustrations when I lived in Britain was that when I would go to a female doctor at the National Health Service for different kinds of examination or whatever, and I hadn't chosen a female doctor, it was just that was the person on roster, was that I would sometimes be told, I'm sorry, I can't see you. There are no male chaperones available to be with you while I examine you, so you'll have to go away.
I don't think I've heard a male. I mean, as a male patient, you should have had a male chaperone to see a female GP.
That's right. And
Okay.
they were, at that time, there was a female chaperone available, but she was not legitimate. It had to be a male chaperone because I was a man. And I said, is there nowhere where I can waive the right to this? You know, I want to be seen. I want to be examined.
And
No.
was that to protect you or to protect the GP?
I asked her, and she said both.
Right. Okay. It's all very. It's all. They're sort of very worrying that a woman who's a GP, you know, needs somebody else in there to see a male patient. I hate to think what she's gone through in order to need that. I don't see how that's going to be solved by having two men in her surgery.
I would have thought, you know, if that's her concern, I would have happily said you can leave the door open. I would happily have had a female person, an additional woman there, or five, ten. I mean, I just, you know.
I haven't, and that's interesting. Yeah, I haven't come across that. In fact, I've never heard that before.
But it is interesting in terms of what you say about trusting women more. And I wonder about that. I wonder if the sorts of fallibilities or failings that people may sense they need to share over something like a divorce matter might be easier for a lot of people to share with women, that women often have good reason not to trust men in general. And maybe men sometimes feel that when there are emotions involved, they can be a little more candid with
Yeah,
them.
and I think people you know, probably expect maybe a bit more understanding and a bit more sympathy from a woman. I mean, these are all you know, stereotypes really, but and that if it's something personal, like, you know, you think somebody's having an affair, or you're being scammed online by someone that you think you've fallen in love with, I think people feel less embarrassed
Embarrassed, I
actually.
think that's the word. And
talking to a
one
woman,
thing, Caitlin.
but I don't know about I don't know about trust, because at the same time, women have long been seen as inherently untrustworthy. You
No,
know,
I think that's absolutely true.
we can't keep our mouths shut and tell a woman something and she'll pass it on. So you've got a bit of a contradiction there, I think.
But I wonder if that has diminished in significance as therapeutic culture and sharing personal details has become more common and the other side has
Possibly.
become more significant. One of the things I think about often and talk to a number of female colleagues about is that when we have office hours as professors, I always have fewer students spending less time with me and talking less about their private lives than the women do. My women colleagues have people bursting into tears, talking about pregnancy, about violence, about personal problems endlessly. You know, they have to do additional emotional duty with both male and female students compared to what is expected of me, and not only me.
I mean, I know what I've worked at universities, on and off in different places for quite a long time. I'm not sure if that's a man-woman thing, though, or whether it's just sort of the individual, because I do, yes, I've often had students telling me, oh, I feel like always actually telling me all the things that have happened to them, or why they're upset or breaking into tears, or but then when I talk to other people, they haven't necessarily experienced that, and it doesn't seem to break down in terms of whether they're a man or a woman.
Well, maybe
But
it's just
who
me.
knows?
Perhaps I just have some sort of.
Maybe you just put them off.
There's some sign that I am offering that says, leave me alone.
And there's something I'm offering that goes, tell me, tell me.
Moving away from my incredibly exciting personal anecdotes about needing a special person to look after me and over me when I'm with a doctor and my total failure as a person to be trusted by students and so on. And back to this theme, you've already mentioned there's a parallel to be drawn between journalism and private investigation. And I wonder if you felt as though there were connections that were real and empirical to you that you could perceive in your training as a journalist much earlier and your training as a PI more recently.
I mean, definitely the two things are very similar. I mean, I didn't have any training as a journalist, so I don't even know if you could study it then. I don't remember. But I became a journalist by chance, really. I'm born in London, and I moved to Botswana in Southern Africa in, was it 1989? Initially as a teacher. But I became a journalist, and at that time, there were no daily, the only daily newspaper was a government, a very slim government publication. And then there were, I think, two or three independent weekly newspapers. So the fact that English was my first language, and that's the language that the newspapers were publishing in, was obviously a big advantage, for me. And so the training I had was sort of here and there. I went to Zimbabwe a couple of times and received, I sort of went on a, I don't know, a training day for a few days with Zimbabwean journalists. So what I was learning from them was the importance of, well, trying not to end up in prison, really, and what to do if you do. So it was very much, taking notes, keeping extremely careful records of everything. I remember that, we were to, you write on your notebook, you never tear a page out of your notebook. You then immediately turn the page over and continue writing on the next page. It was very strict in terms of how we were, recording things. And then the other thing was sources. The importance of protecting your source. Whatever was going to happen to you, you did not give out your source. And then to not be afraid, to not be afraid of being arrested because it was being done to shut you up. And what sort of journalist were you if that was going to stop you? So that was the sort of training that I got as a journalist. And of course, when I started training as a PI, it's very, very similar. I mean, record keeping is incredibly important because if you don't do it properly, and you're in court, the whole thing is just the whole case is going to be thrown out because you haven't delivered the paper properly, or you haven't got the proper affidavits, or you haven't, kept a good log of what you did and when. So you've got to be very accurate and you're fact checking, and of course your sources are very important. And I think the thing of cross checking everything, not believing what somebody tells you, and what source can I believe? At what point do you say this is a fact or this is the truth? So it was very much very the two are very, very similar.
You mentioned earlier divorce as being quite an important component of the work available for private investigators. What sort of proportion of cases one takes on would be about divorce?
A huge proportion. You're talking 90%, to sort of in the early days, because in order to divorce, you needed evidence of, for example, adultery. So how are you going to get that evidence? You're going to get a private detective, and they will need to follow the people that are having an affair. They will need witnesses to that. They will need photographic evidence. So that creates a huge opening for private detectives. And even up until, I don't know, mid-20th century, 80% of a caseload might be, what was called matrimonial cases. And even now, where, with the latest change in the divorce laws in the UK, you don't need evidence, and you don't really need to go to court, as long as both of you agree. So you don't need to be hiring a PI in order to get proof of something. But there's still a huge amount of people that want their partner followed. And they will come to a private detective because they want to know what somebody's up to. But the women that I spoke to, the modern day women, generally don't take on that sort of case, because they'll say, well, you want to know, but you don't need to know. Or they'll have a client that says, I know my boyfriend's having an affair. I want photographs. And it's like, why? Why do you want photographs when you already know what's going on? So modern day PIs will spend a lot of time asking somebody, what is it you want me to do? And why do you want me to do it? And this is not what I do. Whereas in the past, of course, you just go, yeah, fine, and take the job on.
Is my Instamatic. So,
Yeah.
what are they mostly involved with now?
Well, it's always been a big part of the job has always been serving papers. Contrary to the popular culture image of private detectives, which is criminal cases. I mean, I grew up with the Rockford Files and Magnum PI and Charlie's Angels. Where the three women take their instructions from their anonymous male boss, and off they run to solve a murder or something, 30 minutes flat, and put on their bikinis and relax by the pool. In real life, PIs are dealing with civil cases, and so document serving is a huge part of that, and always has been, going back to the Bow Street runners of Victorian London, who were also serving papers. So the papers could be divorce papers, it could be bankruptcy, it could be debt related, it could be fraud, it could be, that's still a big part of the PI's job, is to serve papers.
It's one of the interesting things, isn't it, that hasn't gone virtual and would be tough to render entirely as virtual.
Oh,
So,
sorry, you mean in serving papers?
yes.
Yes, I'm not quite sure how that would work. I mean, I thought when I started the book, the serving papers was like you sort of crept up on somebody, suddenly went, hey, handed them the paper and then ran. I thought that, but actually, it's very interesting. There's a whole set of rules and regulations about how you serve papers. And in the past, you couldn't serve papers on a Sunday. You still can't serve papers in Parliament, I think. And you can serve papers on someone that refuses to take them, as long as you then sort of put that in your report, afterwards.
It doesn't sound terribly glamorous,
Well, that's it, isn't it? That's why
Caitlin.
fiction, we don't see that in fiction. I mean, when I was doing a talk recently, and somebody said, a woman was saying that, she loves crime fiction and she loves documentaries and she loves, movies and TV shows. And she said she'd never seen a British PI in fiction serving papers on anybody because it's not exciting, is it? So it's not something we see. The other thing that's still a big part of a PI's job is missing people. But obviously the way that you find people is very different. So 50 years ago, if someone was missing, you would, start by in their local area. If you went to their local video shop, for example, they would probably know who lived where and what videos they'd taken out that week, and if anybody had moved, and people will go to the same school, people's children, so that's sort of where you would start. People are more dispersed now, so you would start online, and in many ways, a PI's job has become even more anonymous because they're not out there anymore. On the whole, they're like you and me; they're on a screen, they're doing stuff online.
Any temptation to go into the game full time for a bit of extra pocket money?
No, basically, I thought I would be very good at it. Well, not very good, but I thought I would be good because I thought I'm a novelist, I'm a journalist, and surely I must be observant by now. I've been doing this for 35 years. I like to think I pay closer to attention to detail. Women have always been known to be extremely good at private detection, and both men and women have been saying this for, a century and a half. So I thought I had a lot, a lot of advantage in terms of doing it. But no, I wasn't. I was pretty useless, actually, surprisingly useless. But there is a buzz, even though I was not good at what I was given to do, there was that feeling of let me try again and I'll be better this time. Particularly shadowing people, which is much harder than it looks like on TV. And I'd been warned about this countless times that it is difficult, but I still went in there thinking I'd be able to do it. And no, I wasn't. And the other thing is, I don't know, could you pick and choose the jobs? A bit like being a lawyer, I suppose. Do you want to defend somebody that you think is pretty dodgy? If someone comes to you and says, I want my wife followed, do I want to do that? Do I want to follow somebody's wife?
Yeah.
If I have to serve papers on rough sleepers, people who are sleeping in the open air, who've got nowhere to go or have been forced out of where they are, that's still illegal in the UK. That falls under the Vagrancy Act. You want to serve papers on somebody who's, in a sleeping bag and sleeping in a shop doorway. So yeah, I don't think, I wouldn't want to do it. But it's a very broad area and you can specialise. So yeah, you could decide what you want to do.
Now, moving to one of your earlier books from almost a decade ago, Downstream, I wondered if you could tell us a wee bit about that, because it too, and this one I have read and love, I have three of your books, all of which I greatly admire. One of the themes in Downstream, which is about the River Thames and swimming in all its complexity, the history of that amazing river, is the struggle of women to swim legitimately, in inverted commas, and their evisceration from the historiography of swimming. That's a theme that is there too, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and it's not sort of really a conscious theme, but when I look back, I'm like, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm doing sort of over and over again, because it's similar with private detectives and the female professional crooks, is that at the time you'll find some of these swimmers were world leaders. They were incredibly well known and respected, and they broke, incredible records. And
And
yet
Annette
they
Kellerman is
came.
one of the swimmers that you mentioned.
Annette Kellerman, the Australian Annette Kellerman, is one of the women, yes, but even well, and but she is a bit well known because she ended up in Hollywood, and she was a tribute. People sort of say that she designed the first one piece costume for women, so she is a bit known. But before her, when you have people like Agnes Beckwith, for example, who was a 1860s swimmer. And here was, she started at the age of whatever it was, 13, swimming 5 miles in the River Thames. And she was the woman that got me started writing downstream, because I was fascinated that here was this girl in a public space in Victorian England, wearing not much in the way of clothing. I mean, by our standards, she was wearing the tunic and pantaloons, and so she's wearing quite a lot. But the fact is, she's in a public space, being watched by male spectators in what is seen as a male arena, in other words, sport. And in she dives to the River Thames and swims 5 miles. And you just think, that's incredible. And then when I saw that later, she then formed her own troop of what were described as talented lady swimmers. And then she set off to swim across New York Harbour. So it's like, this is amazing. Is this true? And then the question again of, well, was she the only one? Were others doing it as well? Yes, others were doing it. And so then I thought, well, so I could actually do a whole history of swimming the River Thames, because we've got these women at all different ages are using the River Thames as their training ground. Obviously, it's free. It's a very important part of the Thames, an important part of London history, of English history, and of swimming history, and it turned out of women's history as well, because it was where they got to prove themselves that they were physically and mentally more than capable of of doing what men did. And in some cases, you'd have these organized races in the early 1900s where there'd be all men and one woman. So they were actually swimming in the same races together against each other, which I hadn't realized. The River Thames. Have you ever swum in the River Thames?
Well, I grew up at a time when this was frowned upon.
Mm.
And you actually talk about that period in the book. I lived in West London in the 60s and 70s as a child. And we would no more think of swimming in the Thames than we would think of swimming in the toilet. Although we spent a lot of time near it, and I went to fancy, in British terms, public schools, where you had a holiday for the Oxford-Cambridge boat race. My parents would take me on Sunday mornings to sit outside in a pub by the Thames and look at it. But that was all that it was.
Yeah, well, though, I mean, those.
I've swum in the ponds on Hampstead Heath, but much, much later. I did that in the last 10 years.
Well, I think, I mean, that's what happened with it. The Thames was a playground for everybody, from impoverished East End children to kings and queens. I mean, everybody used the Thames. And but by the time you're talking about sort of 60s, 70s, by then we were being told to get out of the Thames, that it was filthy, it was a death trap, it's a dangerous thing to do, and we're being encouraged towards more indoor leisure centres, chlorine, heated water, etc. But when you travel along the Thames, which I did, sort of travel along the whole length, talking to people about their swimming histories and their swimming experience, and an awful lot of people were taught to swim in the Thames. That was a normal pre-Second World War. That was perfectly normal to be taken along to the Thames as part of your class at school, basically thrown in and told to swim. And I had swum as a child, which I'd forgotten until I started the book. And that wasn't in London. But I then decided I need to do some proper swimming in different parts of the Thames to really get an idea of this. So I swam in the upper Thames, not far from the source of the river. And that was a 5-mile swim. I was completely exhausted and completely ecstatic by the end of it.
Can
There's
imagine.
something amazing about swimming along a river because every view is new. You're not going up and down, you're turning corners. And you don't know what's going to happen as you come around the next corner. And of course, you've got the difficulty of where are you going to get out? So, quite different from a pool or the sea, perhaps. And then I did a swim in a more urban environment. So I swam in one of the docks in London. I think it was the Millwall Dock, to just get a feel of what that was like. And then I travelled to where the Thames meets the sea. And swam there as well, which of course the water was salty, and as far as I was concerned, it was the sea. It's very difficult to say where does the river end and where does the sea begin.
One of
Yeah,
the
I think
things.
that was one of the happiest books I've written. In every book, I get threatened by at least somebody, and that one there was only one threat from somebody, but everybody else was really nice because swimmers love the Thames. Swimmers on the whole are a nice bunch of people. They love what they're doing and they want other people to love it as well. So it was a particularly happy book to write.
I recorded a podcast episode not that long ago with Gillian Edelstein, the noted photographer, about a film that she and others made about their swimming in the ponds on the during lockdown, forbidden practice, and how they've kept at it. These people who had no connection other than the fact they ended up converging on the ponds, who go 365 days of the year to
But
this year.
that's a grand tradition that goes back again mid-Victorian times. It's not unusual. People have been doing it for, a very, very, very long time. And I used to swim at the Women's Pond on Hampstead Heath in London. And there was always a cohort of elderly women, and that cohort has changed, obviously, as people die. But yeah, I remember being very struck by the women's changing room. It really wasn't a changing room, it was just a bit of, I can't remember, an open area. And you'd have these women who were elderly, year-round swimmers and just extremely comfortable in themselves, in their own bodies. And, as a girl growing up in London in 60s and 70s, that's not something that you saw very often. There is a certain connection between women and water, women and swimming, I think, because so-called wild swimming has really taken off in the last decade or so. And women in particular, women make up a vast majority of the people who do it.
And you worked as an advisor on a film about this, about the ponds.
Yes, there was a film called The Ponds, which is available on Netflix now. And it was shot mainly at the men's pond. So on Hampstead Heath, you've got three ponds, mixed men's and women's. And the men's, surprise, surprise, is someone that sort of as a proper swimming and diving spot, was the oldest and most organized. And the Ponds filmmakers made a beautiful film watching people at the three ponds. I've written a book about the history of the ponds, so that's why I got to be called a consultant.
Well, I've swum in the men's one and the mixed one, And I guess the big thing for me about the men's one was that the changing rooms, which were, as you've described, for the women, on a hot August afternoon on the weekend, were filled with 300 exquisitely beautiful gay clone men who had no paunch, big muscles, and were there to look and be looked at. And I felt elderly, flabby, and hideous. But because there was such a number of us, and only a certain amount could be allowed into the pond at any one time, you had to stand in a line with people for a very long time, waiting to be able to get in and hide your flab. So I certainly experienced it through my own internal self-surveillance as not quite the accepting space that you've described.
I think that probably would be a summer's day, wouldn't it? Because, the lawn outside, there's been times in that's been quite a cruising spot. The pond has always been seen as a reasonably safe place if you're gay, for men, in the days where, you're constantly, up against, the possibility that you're gonna get beaten up or you're gonna get arrested, or so it's always been a place where, you're reasonably safe there. So it became somewhere that more and more people would go to. But I think, the year-round swimmers, you're not going to be queuing up to get in there, I don't think.
No. I think this was definitely a hot August afternoon sort of experience. And of course, all about my own insecurities and fallibilities. So I've got one last question for you, if I may, Kate. Then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish to what we've discussed. Does that sound all right as a way of
That
concluding?
sounds, yeah.
So
Yes.
my last question is to ask you about fiction writing. Tell us what are some of the differences between non-fiction writing and fiction writing.
And this is quite timely for me because I'm writing a novel. I've gone back to novel writing. That's what I'm doing at the moment because I've done three non-fiction books in a row, I think. I could talk about this for ages. In terms of earning a living with non-fiction, you can get a contract and money from a publisher without having written the book. So that is, when you're trying to earn a living, and as you may know, professional writers in the UK now earn, I think it's 8 or 9,000 pounds a year from their writing. So it's a very difficult job to survive financially. You've always got to be doing a lot of other jobs at the same time. So with non-fiction, although you have to write a very detailed proposal and synopsis and sample chapters, at least you then have a contract, you have a little bit of money up front, and it's going to become a book. Whereas with a novel, you need to write the whole thing, unless you're extremely well known. You need to write the whole thing and then go through the agonies of, sending it around and trying to get it published. And so I've started writing a novel which is about a private detective, and it's set in Charles Dickens' household in Broadstairs in 1857. And Dickens was a man who was very obsessed with his reputation. So when a private document goes missing, he calls on the services of his friend Charles Field, who we mentioned at the beginning, and
Yes.
he sends a young woman in undercover to solve the
Okay.
crime. The thing is that you can have it all mapped out in your head, and then when you sit down to write, it's like, how am I going to do that? With non-fiction, the struggle is getting the information, trying to make sure that you've done the best that you can in terms of getting that information, that it's as accurate as you think it is, and then turn it into a story so that people want to turn the page and you're not boring them and it's not all dry and academic and whatever. With fiction, of course, you've got to make it up. You're starting from scratch. So it's a much slower process. But having said that, you've got more freedom. When you're writing about women who are in Holloway Prison, or women who are criminals, or women who are private detectives, you've got this, I feel, this incredible responsibility. That I need to not be judgmental. I need to get it right. I need to try and be understanding. I need to not glorify somebody. You know, these were not all crusading feminists, and particularly with criminals, obviously they were committing crime. But to have sort of rounded portraits of women,
Yes.
that's really, you know, what I'm after. So yes, I'm back to fiction at the moment.
That's exciting. Well, Caitlin, I'd like to hand it to you now to finish by inviting you to add anything. You might be adding to things we've already discussed where you want to put some more material in, or you might be wanting to raise a new topic.
I think I'm fine, actually. Thank you for reading the three books. That's really good to know. And I feel like there's a little bit of a sea change at the moment in terms of taking books like these seriously. And it's, to me, it's just sort of happened in the last 6 months or so, that I've always wanted to see the women I write about. I want to see them on the screen. And suddenly the interest is just much bigger than it's ever been before. So there seems to be some truth in trying to get women's stories, you know, out there into popular culture. So I'm hoping this is the you know, that this will continue.
Indeed. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.